after year.
Howdy, folks.
Yes, it is your old friend Singing Sam. So let's just settle back and reminisce a bit. What do you say, huh?
With a nostalgic nod toward the Atwater Kent, we now present Same Time, Same Station, a chronicle of broadcasting's first half century.
Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
Tonight, the story of...
Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, is on the air, in person, to get you to eat Wheaties. Yesterday, after the Pelican caught fire, Jack offered to take a line across the packed ice floes so that Captain Hands and his men might be rescued with a breeches boy. Here we are on deck. Jack has just started across. Listen.
Get off there, man! I ain't with that barking tackle! Look alive,
there,
you men!
Watch it, lad. Go easy.
Yes, there's lots of time, Jack. I'll get them. Just keep paying off the line.
Sing out if you need help. I'll come after you.
We'll be watching you all the way, Jack. We can see you playing against the fire on the Pelican. If you get into trouble, we won't leave you out there.
Okay, but don't come unless I call. On.
Better not shout to him anymore. Let him give all his attention to what he's doing. He'll need to be on the alert every step of the way.
Aye, and I hate to see him go where I can't help him.
Seems to me he's going too fast.
That's all right. He's getting along swell at the start.
First ice floe is pretty solid. There'll be others far more treacherous.
And the worst of it is there'll be places where we can't see him. Those big hummocks will hide him more and more as he goes along.
Oh, they will. And just when we're most anxious to see him.
I believe he'll pick his way so he'll keep in sight as much as he can.
I hope he doesn't try. He ought to pick the best way and forget everything else.
Aye, and we've still got the line to keep track of him by. If he stops pulling it out, we'll know something's happened.
Aren't you paying it out a bit too fast, Captain? It's coiling up down below us on the ice.
I want it to. I aim to give him plenty of slack so as to put as little drag on him as possible.
If only it doesn't get tangled up in those big hummocks.
I don't see how it can, unless it's caught in a crack or something. The ice is so smooth it ought to slide easy all the way. I'll bet he hardly feels it.
He'll feel it before he's through. He'll be pulling quite a weight of it by the time he's clear across.
Aye, but it can't be helped.
Dear, maybe we should have used a lighter one.
This one's as light as we dared use, Betty. It has to be strong enough to pull two heavy ropes across when we get it there. Tackle, too, if the men on the Pelican need it. There'll be no time for pulling it back and forth.
They'll have their own tackle. No ship would be without it.
They have a fire on board, Captain. We can't tell what's been destroying.
Gee, it sure is blazing up now. The worst of it seems to be in the back and the stern of the ship, though.
Use the glasses, Northrop. See what's up on board.
Yes, Captain. I'd forgotten them. I was so busy watching Jack.
He's still getting along swell.
Yes, but he's going behind the first big hummock now.
Well, we'll see him again when he gets a little beyond it.
You watch the Pelican, Northrop. Keep the glasses on her and tell us what the men are doing. You ought to see him plain the way the blaze is now. We'll keep track of Jack.
Very well. But if you'd prefer to use the glasses yourself, Captain...
I've got my job here paying out the rope.
Gosh, Jack's out of sight now.
He's still going along at the same rate, though. You can tell by the way the rope slides out.
Maybe the men in the Pelican can see him.
They ought to be now if they've had their own glasses on us.
But it's not as bright over here as it is there. They won't be able to see so well.
What can you make out, Northrop? Do they seem to be watching him?
No, I don't believe they've noticed him yet. They're still fighting the fire as best they can.
Then they don't know what they're trying to do.
Is the fire much worse?
Yes, and it'll probably spread faster from now on. Some of the men are gathered way up in the bow. It must be getting plenty warm over there.
There's one man up on the bridge.
That'll be Hans himself, Betty.
Yeah. He's starting to wave his arms and shout. Some of the men are running to the rail. They're looking this way and pointing. They've seen Jack at last. Hans must have spotted him.
Good.
Oh, they're fine.
Good
for
him. I'm so glad.
It's about time. Now watch close, Northrop. Hans will know what we're doing. You can soon tell whether they've got tackle or not.
He's shouting some kind of orders. The men are running from the bow. They're going to do something, all right.
It'll save a lot of time if they can get ready.
Aye, and they'll know it.
They've got tackle, all right. They're running to the forward mast to rig it up. Hands is helping.
Oh, look, they're sending up another red rocket.
What can that mean?
It's most likely to let us know that they've seen Jack.
Or else it's to tell us that the fire's almost too hot for them.
Well, I hope it doesn't make Jack feel he has to go faster.
I wish we could see him again.
He's not going as fast as he was at the start. The rope's paying out slower.
I feel sure he'll keep his head and be careful about all the way.
Yup, he won't forget what's at stake.
Yes, but what if those men have to leave the ship before he gets to them?
They don't aim to, or they wouldn't be working at the tackle.
They're getting it up. I can see it clearly now.
I hope Hans doesn't forget. I see.
Oh, racist.
Gosh, the rope stopped. Jack must be stuck.
It jerked first and then stopped.
Aye, 6 or 8 feet shot forward all of a sudden. It's not moving now.
Oh, what could have happened? Do you suppose he slipped and fell?
That wouldn't cause so much rope to jerk forward.
No, he pulled on it for some reason.
It may have been to tell us he was in trouble. I'd better start after him. Captain...
Not yet, Billy. He said he'd yell if he needed help.
Yes, and we could hear him if he did. He's not more than 50 or 60 yards out.
If we could only see him.
Clean your glasses on the line with that hummock he went behind, Northrop. See if you can make out anything at all.
I can't, Captain. Not a thing. The rope winds around behind it and... But wait. It seems to be moving there. Yes, it is.
It just some more.
Yep, it did. 3 or 4 more feet shot out.
And there's Jack. He's moving over into full view.
Oh, he is. I can see him now.
So can I.
Sure enough.
He's looking back and waving. He moved out on purpose so we could catch sight of him.
Well, what could be the matter? Has he reached the place he can't get past?
I see. He's shouting something.
That means I've got to go.
Wait,
but it's...
Quiet, Billy. Listen sharp, all of you.
It's all right. Don't come after me. I've got to make a jump.
What did he say?
He's got to make a jump.
Aye.
Great Scott. That must mean he's reached the stretch of open water.
Oh.
Yep, that's it. He's stepping back for a short run before he takes off.
But he'll slip. He's almost shorted on that ice, and the rope will hold him back.
Not a great deal. He took care of that by jerking it forward. He wanted some slack at his feet so he wouldn't feel the pull of the whole length of it while he was jumping.
Aye, he's keeping his wits about him.
Oh, he's getting ready to run.
Can you see the open water, Northrop?
Yes, the thin black strip. I can't tell how wide it is from this angle, though. At a rough guess, I'd say 8 or 10 feet, possibly more.
How can he make it from a slippery takeoff?
I'll bet he picked a spot with his rough ice at the edge.
But even so...
There he goes.
Oh, if he slips, if he slips at the edge...
He didn't. He made a clean jump.
What'd I say?
Oh, he went down. I can't see him.
Gosh, he fell, didn't he?
Yes.
Did he go under? Did he fall back in the water?
If he did, I'll...
No, he slipped as he landed on the other side. He fell flat and slid forward.
That may have knocked him out. Is he moving?
Yes, he's getting up. He's on his feet again. He's all right. He's going on.
Oh, my, what a relief.
Oh, gracious, I hope he doesn't have to do that again.
He's more than halfway across, anyhow.
Aye, and the rope's paying out steady now. I'm hoping the worst is over.
You've seen the wisdom of letting him make the attempt, Captain. I doubt if any of your crew could have made that jump safely.
You're right, Northrop. Neither you nor I could have done it. But get your glasses back on the Pelican again. See what's going on.
Most of the men are crowding back to the rail to watch Jack. They've done about all they can to make ready for the breaches, boy. Captain Hands is back on the bridge with his glasses trained on Jack. They've about given up trying to fight the fire.
They will as well. If Jack reaches them safely, we'll have all of them off in half an hour.
Captain Campbell, sir.
Aye, McGregor. How are the men coming?
We've finished, sir. The breeches boy is ready for the hawser and the ropes to be started across.
Good. Bring him here then, so we'll have them ready.
I've got them, sir. I'll pass them to the end of this light line if you want.
Go ahead and tell the men to stand by on deck.
They will. I couldn't get them to go below for tried. They're too anxious to watch the lad making his way across the ice. I gave him permission to line up along the rail, if you don't mind.
Of course I don't mind. It's a thing worth watching, and I wouldn't begrudge it to anyone.
He's out of sight again.
And say, the line's not going out as smoothly as it was. It slides out fast for a few seconds, and then stops.
He's feeling the drag of it that way. He's pulling on it with his hands to ease the pull at his waist.
He must be getting dreadfully tired. Oh, I do wish we could keep him in sight.
The farther away he gets, the easier the men on the Pelican can see him. And they're watching every move he makes.
There he is. I can see him again. But there's something wrong. I can't make him out clearly anymore, but... He seems to be bobbing up and down.
Yeah. And the rope stopped moving.
Get your glasses on him, Northrop.
Oh, what is it? I believe he's waving again.
No, he's not. He's got his arms out to keep his balance. I know what's happened. He's going across a thin sheet of ice that's loose from the rest. It's giving a little under his weight.
Oh, my.
Gee, will he make it, do you think?
Yes, it's holding him. If he doesn't have another gap to jump across, he'll be all right.
Watch him close.
I will. He's steady again now. I believe he stepped over on the firm ice. Yes, he has.
Yep. There goes a strong pull on the line.
That was one of those treacherous places I was worried about.
Oh, my, it's one thing after another.
The worst is over, Mrs. Northrop. I think you needn't worry now.
But he still has quite a ways to go.
Only 20 yards or so.
Aye, if anything happens to him now, the men on the Pelican will go to his rescue.
I don't believe he'll have any more trouble. The ice looks firm and unbroken the rest of the way.
Oh, good.
Gee, then we'll soon have the breeches boy working.
That we will.
But say, I've never seen a breeches boy in action. But won't the cable give? I mean, the men will drag along the ice part of the way.
That won't matter. We'll not pull them fast enough to hurt them any.
Jack's nearly there. The men are waving and shouting to him. Captain Hands is coming down from the bridge to join them at the rail.
And there goes another red rocket.
I suppose they're setting it off to let us know Jack's nearly with them. Gee, don't they think we're paying any attention to them?
I don't believe that's what the rocket means, Billy.
Then what are they for?
To warn us that the fire is spreading dangerously fast. To let us know we'll have to work the breeches boy fast when we get it started.
McGregor, have you got that cable fast to the line?
Aye, Captain. I've greased the lock, too, so she'll slide easy if she hits a rough spot.
Jack ought to be the first one to come across.
I don't believe he will. He'll figure he can come back across the ice if he has to.
He's nearly there. He's nearly there.
Yes, by Jove. There's no question of what he'll make it now.
And he's going as strong as ever. Look at the pull on that line.
Boy, I knew he could do it.
He's almost at the Pelican side. The men are reaching down to pull him up. Captain Hands is pushing them aside to be the first one to grab him.
Hands knows courage when he sees it, Bugatti.
He's got him. Jack's made it. Hands is lifting him up on deck.
Good for him.
Boy, oh, boy.
Good for the lad. Hands, give him a cheer. The lad's won his way across to the rescue. Let her ring out so he can hear it.
Quick, over with the cables, McGregor. They're pulling the line taut.
Over she goes, Captain.
Stand by, men!
There goes another red rocket. They want us to hurry. The time may be far shorter than we think.
So Jack reaches the Pelican safely at last. But will there be time to rescue Captain Hands and the crew? Be sure to listen in at the same time tomorrow evening to find out what happens next.
The radio career of the All-American Boy spanned 17 seasons, from 1933 to 1950. Tonight it's our pleasure to present the first Jack Armstrong, Mr. Jim Amici.
Auditions were called for a brand new show called Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. This was in, the early summer or the late spring of 1933, and I had to go into Chicago for the auditions. And finally, they auditioned hundreds of voices around the Midwest. And I received a call one day from Chicago telling me to report for rehearsals at such and such a date. And luckily, I wound up as the original Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy. We hit the air, I believe it was July the 2nd, 1933. And it was so exciting because I was just a youngster then. We were all youngsters. And there was a great array of talent in Chicago at that time. I don't have to tell you about your Les Tremaines, your Hal Perrys. What was the name of Stan, who later became the voice of the 20th, 20 Mule Team, Borax. The old-timer, at any rate. And we had some great, great personalities that performed on the show. And we had great directors. We had great production men at that time. Because at this time and place in the theatrical history of America, the Chautauqua circuits were on the demise. Summer stock was on the demise. This, we're talking about the middle of the Depression. And people just didn't have money to afford any of the frills of life. So they flocked into this new medium called radio. And consequently, a great many of them wound up as directors and producers. And therefore, that's why I say we received basically some of the finest training that anyone in this business ever received. We worked under people who demanded perfection. I don't really know whether you could classify Jack Armstrong as a soap opera or that was the intention, because Skippy was already on the air, and that had achieved a gigantic success for General Mills. Just a tremendous success. And so this was like a step above. Skippy had more of an appeal to the younger children. And it was like Jack Armstrong filled a void between the younger children and the adults. And peculiarly enough, after we were on the air a while, we not only had a gigantic following among children, we had a gigantic following among adults as well. Now, the original people, there was Jack Armstrong, Billy and Betty Fairfield, and Uncle Jim. Now, the original Billy Fairfield was a fellow by the name of Murray McLean. And he later went on to become, he left Jack Armstrong to become, there was a flying show that he did for Skelly Oil. I forget what the title of it was. It skips me at the moment. But it was for Skelly Oil Company. It became quite a popular series at the time. The girl, Betty Fairfield, was played by a young girl by the name of Shandel Kalish, who left Jack Armstrong to go on to the New York stage, and she became the first star of Girls in Dormitory, I believe. This is back in the 1930s. And Sarah Jane Wells replaced her as Betty Fairfield. This all happened within the first year that we were on the air. And then a fellow by the name of John Gannon replaced Murray McLean as Billy Fairfield, and he played it. And Sarah Jane continued to play Betty up until the time that I left the show in 1939. So they probably continued on past then, although you couldn't prove it one way or the other by me. We had a gigantic success as far as audience acceptance was concerned. And there's always the thought that comes to mind. The first time they ran a contest, This shows you the power, the drawing power, the selling power of radio back in those days as compared even to the selling power of TV in this modern day and age. The first time they ran a contest was in the fall of 1933. Now, we had only been on the air for a period of three and a half months. And it ran for 3 weeks. You had to send in a dime, I believe, and two box tops, and you got a whistle or something in return. It skips my mind exactly what it was. But in the span before the 3 weeks were even out, the shelves of every grocery store in America were stripped of Wheaties boxes. And they never made this mistake again. From that point on, and we ran many contests after that, whenever they ran a contest, they stockpiled freight cars at strategic locations throughout America. And the minute the contest began, they began sending them on their way. Hundreds and thousands of freight cars loaded with Wheaties. It gives you an idea of what radio could do as far as selling. Oh, and also, here's another interesting spotlight about Jack Armstrong. When I began, my brother Don played the part of Captain Hughes, which was one of the four major parts on the show. And he had to leave the show after about 3 months because people got a little confused over whether Captain Hughes was speaking or whether Jack Armstrong was speaking. And that was the time that Stan Andrews, that's the name of the fellow that became the old-timer on the 20 Mule Team Borax, he came in and played the part of Captain Hughes. I was only 17 years old when I started.
Those poor men. I'll bet they don't break. There's another ship this close.
Yes, but we let them know. All right, Billy. Okay. Step back, Billy. Watch it, Billy.
Yes, be careful.
Here goes. You better flip. Jerk your hand away.
Ooh, yay, a beat.
Yup, straight up.
How about setting off another one?
No, they'll see that all right. There's no use wasting them.
They've seen us. They're sending up another red one right after us to let us know.
Golly, it can't be more than a quarter mile away now. I wonder what ship it could be.
The captain may know by this time. He must be watching it through his night glasses.
Then let's hustle back up on the bridge and get the dope.
Not yet. Let's find out if Mr. McGregor needs more help with those tenders.
Okay.
Hi there, Lodge. Nice work. You set off a good one.
Stevens is going to look for you, Mr. McGregor. We're ready to turn through on those tenders if you want us to.
There's no need, Lodge. The men can handle them. The captain's cut our speed down again, so we'll have time.
Have you seen the ship in distress yet?
No, but you can see the solid ice if you look dead ahead. Step over to the rail.
Come on. Let's
go.
It almost takes your breath away. Those ice floes are heaped up there in a million different shapes.
A million is right. They stretch both ways as far as you can see.
Now, here's another facet about Armstrong, Jack Armstrong, that might prove interesting to you. In the early years when we first went on the air, we were on the CBS network. Later, we moved to NBC, but initially we were on CBS. And CBS at that time, only their entire network, I think, was comprised of, it was either 88 or 98 stations. And General Mills wanted, there were certain key cities that they wanted in addition to the cities that CBS could supply them with. So there were, I believe, 38 extra cities that they wanted to carry the show. So what we had to do, we had to, this is in the days of the ETs, electrical transcriptions. Tape or wire recording hadn't even been discovered. Tape, I think, wasn't discovered until the Germans came up with it sometime during World War II. And so what we had to do, we had to record 3 weeks ahead of time, and we used to lay down the master voice tracks on a great big plate of wax. It was probably 2 inches thick and 20 inches in diameter, and it weighed a ton. And you laid down the engineer then. We had to record up at Old World Broadcasting, which incidentally was the first station in America that ever broadcast television. This was on top of the Daily News building in Chicago. They still had their gigantic equipment in the back rooms that they used to send out their TV signals with. This is about 1929 or 28 that they tried sending it out. And it was on top of the Daily News building in Chicago, and it was a gigantic room. It was probably, must have been 40 feet wide by 60 feet in depth. And above us was the roof, a tarred metal roof. And, of course, air conditioning hadn't been even dreamed of in those days. So during the summer, when we had to go out there, we always cut our electrical transcriptions in the morning. We started at 8:45 in the morning, and we worked till about 12 or 12:30. This goes to show you how finicky and how fussy they were about shows in those days. You took 3.5 to 4 hours to cut a 15-minute show. And, of course, you had your sound effects men. Sound effects were all done live then. There was no such thing as phonograph records carrying sound effects. Anything you needed with the sound effects was done live. And they had some brilliant men back in Chicago that used to dream up sound effects. I can remember at WBBM, which was the station for CBS in Chicago, they had the whole underground part of the Wrigley building was covered with little cubby holes of various sound effects that they used to dream up and put together. And, but at any rate, getting back to recording the show on top of World Broadcasting Studios, on top of the Daily News building, in the summer, if we had a sequence where we had to run, you ran. You ran for 4 hours with maybe 2 or 3 minutes time out while they'd fuss around with sound effects. But this was what you did. You really got your exercise. If you were jogging, you jogged. If you were climbing the Alps, you climbed. I don't care where you were. You physically, manually exerted yourself to a point that the perspiration just used to drip off your brow, and we'd be standing in a puddle of perspiration. This is no bunk. This is an absolute, actual fact. And anybody that worked on the show back in those days can tell you. So, and if you made a mistake anywhere in that 14 minutes and 30 seconds that you were on the air, the engineer would put down the lathe and he'd wipe off the top of the wax plate clean and you would start all over again. It had to be word perfect. For 14 minutes and 30 seconds, you had to be word perfect. And I remember there was one show that was really a Jonah to us. We just had problems with this right from the word go. We began blowing it the first time we tried to record it. It took us 4 days. Now, mind you, this was like 4 hours a day. We cut it on 14 different occasions, and finally, on the 15th time, it took. And I can remember, I think it was on the 14th go-round, there was a fellow by the name of Henry Sachs, rather elderly man. I say elderly now, looking back. Maybe I'm his age at that point in his life. But we had just finished it. We were in the closing commercial, and he was standing over with his back to one of the tubs of water that the sound effects man had used. And he took one step backward, and that was just enough to throw him off balance. And all you could hear was this whoop and this gigantic splash of water. And that was the... And here, after we'd gone all the way through the show, this is in the closing commercial. So we had to do it once more, but it took.
And by the way, all you fellows and girls, the makers of Wheaties, Jack Armstrong, Billy and Betty, and all our other friends on the Jack Armstrong program are wishing every one of you and your fathers and mothers the very happiest New Year you have ever had. And we hope you fellows and girls who are just starting to follow the keen adventures of Jack Armstrong are planning to be with us every day of this coming year. For Jack Armstrong has lots of adventures ahead of him that he wants you to share. And all you fellows and girls who have been following Jack's adventures every day this year, we want to thank you for being our friends. And we hope you'll continue to be with us for another full year of fun and adventures. And so today, we're saying...
This is Jack Armstrong wishing all you fellows and girls the world's best New Year.
Happy New Year, everybody.
And that goes double for me. Come on now, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Have you tried Wheaties? They're whole wheat with all of the brand. Won't you try?
This was put together by Blackett, Sample, and Hummert, which is like the grandfather of Dancer Fitzgerald and Sample today. And they, incidentally, this was also the era when advertising agencies first came of age, when they were like first born in the early 30s. And Blackett, Sample, and Hummert was one of the largest in the business at that time. And they were very businesslike. When our scripts were completed and sent to us, they were always done ahead of time. And there were no changes. Whatever you did on the ET 3 weeks ahead of time, that was exactly the way you did the show on the air 3 weeks later. And 3 weeks later, you did two shows. Here again, I'll get back to that eastern and western leg of the network. We did one at 4:45 and another at 5:45. Ed Prentice worked on the show. Arch Obler was one of our good friends back during that time. Well, I guess anybody that was associated with radio worked Jack Armstrong back in the early, Forrest Lewis, Stan Andrews, Olin Soule, anybody who was anybody did the show, because everybody worked all shows then.
So I went to...
As the radio career of Jack Armstrong entered the 40s, another young actor would soon audition for the part.
And with taking auditions as an actor all this time, and with a bunch of people who were also later to be quite successful, a few of them, Dick York and some others, we discovered where the scripts were thrown away at NBC. And we became friendly with the page boys and things there, and we'd go grab the scripts at night and steal a studio. And we were friendly with everybody. We'd go into a studio, and everybody would play every part. We'd hand the scripts around and say, all right, now you do this and you do that. And we'd keep practicing this way until finally we had it down pretty good, and suddenly every one of us began winning auditions and doing things in a way we
Young went. Rye Billsbury, whose name is now Mike Rye, was a busy radio voice in Chicago.
And then I would zip over to another studio where I was an evil 40-year-old producer. Having now passed the age of 40, I have certain, you'll excuse the expression, wry feelings about that. of an evil 40-year-old producer on Backstage Wife. And then I would finish that and go into Studio B, the big studio where the Carnation Contented Hour played at night once a week. And in Studio B, we had three sound men and the cast of Jack Armstrong. I'd do Jack Armstrong in Studio B for 2 years. And it had the viewing glass on the 20th floor. You could look down from the 20th floor into the studio on the 19th. And we did it there. It was a three sound man show, and very fast. You did this sort of thing. You did the children's shows at what was known as Kid Pace. And Kid Pace was a very fast speed. We would sometimes have a script as much as 20 pages, whereas the script that I had just come from, namely Backstage Wife, could be 10 pages. So it would be twice the speed of the other one. And if you took a breath at the wrong time, they were half a page beyond you. You had to be really on top of it. I remember the audition for Jack Armstrong. One of the things I had to do, the director, Jim Jewell, said, now read it as fast as you can, without regard for anything except speed. Yes. Because of the Kid Pace, you had to be accurate.
Well, of course. Now, I go back to the absolute beginnings of the show. The man who dreamed it up, who helped dream it up, was a fellow by the name of David Owen, who is no longer alive. He was the producer and director and the announcer of the show. And actually, what he maintained, I wouldn't call it a fast pace by any manner of means. He wanted an intense pace. You had to play your part to the best of your ability. There was never any letdown. There was an intenseness to the show, which you cannot confuse with speed. I believe he left right around the same time I left, and he went to become professor of speech at Michigan University.
I think the feeling could be characterized as professional. I've heard the shows now, and they don't sound as professional as we worked at them. The amount of professionalism that was in the people who were doing those jobs is not that apparent. But they were all talented people, and they all did a very good job.
They all paid money. They paid equal amounts of money. When a call went out to an actor, he was just as anxious to perform on Jack Armstrong as he was on First Nighter.
As I'd be going through the sound lock with my briefcase, these days I carry an attaché case, but those days it was a briefcase. And as I'd go through, I'd say to myself, all right, who am I? And I'd have to figure my character, my style, my sound, voice, whole thing, because I would change my voice. And of course, for someone who was playing Jack Armstrong and Mr. First Nighter at the same time, that's the high on the low of the range. I was getting higher than I should on the Jack Armstrong recordings that you undoubtedly have. because he wanted me to be so careful to be away from a lower voice that it was almost a piping high. It wasn't quite the high that I wanted. I wanted to have a little more character in it, and the director didn't. So I had to do what he said. So it turned out much more of a piping high voice than I wanted. But that brings up an interesting moment. Dick York played my sidekick, Billy, for much of the time that I was Jack. And I was on a vacation in New York in the 1950s. And we're driving down the street one night. And there was the marquee for Tea and Sympathy. And I said, oh, my old sidekick, Billy, Dick York, is in Tea and Sympathy. And it's just 11 o'clock and they must be just finishing. Stop. I want to run back and see if I can see him. So I ran down the alleyway and talked to the stage doorman. Told him who I was and what I wanted to do. So he let me in. And I could hear the applause. They were just coming off. And I stood behind the flat right there. And Dick came off after his last bow. And what did I say? I said, hey, Billy, Uncle Jim wants to see you right away. And he nearly dropped dead. It was such a shock. The poor guy, he was totally in another part, of course. And he'd been in Tea and Sympathy, which is a very sensitive play. And he'd come off and the applause was ringing in his ears. And here's this nut Jack.
Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy.
Wave the flag for Hudson High, boys. Show them how we stand. Ever shall our team be champions, known throughout the land.
The black vulture hovers over our nation, casting a shadow of crime on our war effort. The black vulture, symbol of dishonesty, of selfishness, of greed. Jack Armstrong and Billy Fairfield are a few miles from Chicago, in an old roadhouse which is the headquarters of the Black Vulture's most deadly enemy, the Silencer. They follow the old newsman who brought Uncle Jim's briefcase out to the Silencer. Uncle Jim's plan to capture the notorious black marketeer, the Black Vulture, hinges on the rivalry of these two gang leaders. He believes that when the Silencer finds out that the briefcase is filled with counterfeit coupons instead of the genuine stamps he paid for, he will lead Jack Armstrong and Billy to the Vulture's hideout. It looks as though Uncle Jim's reasoning was sound. For yesterday, we heard the Silencer give orders to the old newsman to contact members of his gang and have them appear at the roadhouse. Just as the old man started out of the building, the Silencer heard Jack and Billy in the hallway upstairs. Let's find out if our two friends were discovered.
Have your gun ready, Harry. I tell you, I heard a noise at the head of these stairs.
Maybe the wind just blew the door open.
We'll see. All right, turn that light out. All right, duck down now. Duck down. I'll push this door open all of a sudden. If you hear anyone move out there, shoot.
Okay, boss.
Whenever you're ready. Here we go. You hear anything?
No, not a thing. But look, the outside door is open.
That must have been what I heard. I thought I closed that door, though.
You did? Well, I don't think you locked it.
Well, it's a cinch nobody could hide in this hall. The rest of these doors are locked tight.
There's nobody else out here, is there, boss?
Nah, some of the boys came out with me, but they drove back into town a little while ago.
Well, look, boss. You want me to get in your car and round up the boys, don't you?
Yeah. Get into the city as soon as possible. Have the whole gang meet me out here. I don't care how late they show up, but tell them to get out of here before tomorrow morning. I'll show that black vulture he can't pull a fast one on me. Here's what's wrong. Night locks off the door. The wind must have blown it open.
You want me to tell the guys to come well-heeled?
Yes. Tell them to bring their guns. The vulture's probably got a mob just waiting for us to show up. I told him I'd pay him a visit if everything wasn't on the up and up. He thinks he's too important anyhow. It's about time somebody put him in his place.
You're the one who can do it, boss. Hey, look. How much extra dough is there in for me if I get the guys rounded up for you?
That chiseler, Harry. Okay, there's $25 in it for you.
Hey, thanks, Alistair. Thanks a lot. Where's your car?
It's out and back. Come on. I'll walk out there with you. Now, look. Get one thing straight. Tell the mob that I want him to get out here as soon as possible. And look, if Tony's come back to town, tell him I'd like to use his bulletproof car.
We'll take this vulture guy for a nice little ride. And think of it, it doesn't pay to double-cross the Silencer.
Yeah, boss. I'd rather get in touch with Tony, too.
Come on.
Come on, Jack. Let's get out of here before that guy gets back.
Okay, Billy. Drop down to the floor. It's a good thing this old chandelier was strong enough to hold both of us. Go ahead, drop down to the floor.
Okay, Jack. Here I go.
Stand clear down there. I can't see where I'm jumping in the dark.
Okay, Jack. I'm standing clear.
Boy, oh boy. When I heard those two guys start up the stairway, I thought sure we'd be caught. It was an inspiration of yours to get up on that chandelier.
They never thought to look over their heads, thank goodness. Well, what now, Jack? What do we do?
Well, the first thing we're going to do is get out of this building. Come on.
Gee whiz, Uncle Jim was right about this whole thing, wasn't he? The silencer is out to get the Black Vulture.
Uncle Jim is very seldom wrong, Billy. Be careful when you step outside. Stay close to the building. Here, I better go first. Follow me, Billy.
Okay, Jack, I'm right behind you.
I wonder where those two fellows went.
They said the car was around the back of the building. That's this way, Jack.
Well, keep your eyes open, Billy. Harry's got the car started. Oh, boy, this place will be busy in a few hours, won't it?
And how? The silencer told him to bring the whole gang out here. Gee whiz, I wish we could get in touch with Uncle Jim.
There's no chance of that now, Billy.
Get down. He's coming out on this driveway.
Yes, hide here in this tall grass on the side of the building.
Move over, Jack, move over. I'm practically on the driveway.
Okay, Billy. How's that? Lie perfectly still, Billy. The silencer's coming this way. Oh, I hope he doesn't turn on that flashlight again.
I won't even breathe, Jack.
I'll show that Black Vulture that he's just a small town mug. Sell me out for 25,000 bucks, will he? I'll show him.
Keep down, Billy. Keep down.
I got my face right in the mud. He went back in the roadhouse, Jack. Now, come on. Let's get back to civilization where we can telephone Uncle Jim.
We don't dare leave now, Billy. We have to keep our eye on that man every second.
But why, Jack? He said his gang won't be out here until, well, maybe a couple of hours. By that time, we could get to a telephone and call Uncle Jim.
I know we could, Billy. But you remember what Uncle Jim told us. We should try to keep our eyes on that briefcase until the silencer takes us to the Black Vulture. Now, those are Uncle Jim's instructions, and we have to follow them out to the letter. I'll tell you what we better do, though, Billy.
What's that?
I noticed the rural free delivery mailbox at the entrance to this driveway.
Yes, so did I, Jack, but how's that going to help us?
Have you got a pencil?
Yeah, I got a pencil. Want some paper, too?
No. Oh, tear a page out of my notebook.
But what are you going to do?
I'm going to write Uncle Jim a short note and put it in that mailbox just as precaution.
Does that mean you intend to stay out here for a couple of days?
If necessary, Billy, yes. Now, come on. Let's get over to that mailbox and I'll write the note.
Gee whiz, Jack. The mailman never comes out here to this club anymore. It's been closed for years. What good will it do to put a note in the mailbox?
It may not do any good, Billy. But then again, what if we're captured? How will Uncle Jim or the FBI men know where this place is?
That's why I think it'd be a good idea to get someplace where we can telephone. We have the number of Betty's hotel.
All right, Billy. If you want to do that, go ahead.
You mean alone?
One of us has to stay here and watch out for that briefcase.
Okay, Jack. We'll both stay then. Well, here's your mailbox. It hasn't been used for 5 years. Look, it's all rusty.
Now, let me have that pencil.
What are you going to write?
I'm just going to write down the name of this roadhouse. There we are. Quiet Haven. My initials, J.A. Let me see. I better... Yes, I'll write up with Jim's name and address on the other side. James Fairfield Hotel, Chicago, Illinois.
But how will he get it? We don't have a stamp.
I have a stamp here in my wallet. Hold this a second, Billy.
Okay.
Sure, I have one here someplace. Yes, here we are. Okay, let me have it, Billy. I'll just paste it right here on the upper right-hand corner. There you are. Now, put it inside that mailbox.
I'll bet you 2-1 the mailman doesn't pick it up.
Put it in anyhow. Well, now, Billy, raise that little tin flag. That'll show that there's something in there.
Oh, is that what those little tin flags are for?
Yes. When they're raised, it means that there's some mail to be picked up. Now, come on, let's get back to the roadhouse. If we're able to watch the silencer, we may learn more about the black market operations.
Okay, Jack. Hey, look, here comes another car.
It couldn't be the old newsman Harry coming back already.
Why not? Maybe just drove to a gas station someplace and telephoned the mob.
No, he wouldn't do that, Billy. Maybe some farmer who lives down this side road. We'd better be careful to stay out of the beam of his headlights just in case it's another member of the silencer's gang.
Well, look, why can't we just lie here in the tall grass again? Why do we have to go back inside that roadhouse?
We'll be safer hiding in there than we would be out here. Say, that automobile is really speeding along this rough road.
He's gonna see us standing here at the gate. Come on.
Billy, I just happened to think of something. We won't have any way of following the silencer when he and his gang go to the Vulture's hideout.
Doggone it, that's right, Jack.
I'll tell you what we'll do, Billy. We'll watch our chance and take the distributor head off one of their cars. That'll force him to leave it behind.
Hey, that's a swell idea, Jack. But boy, it'll be plenty dangerous.
Yes, I know it will, Billy. Oh, fall flat in your face in the grass. That automobile's gonna turn in here. See, it's slowing down.
Oh, girl, the mosquitoes are plenty thick in this high grass.
Stop complaining. It hides us perfectly.
Boy, Jack, look at the size of that automobile. That caused plenty of dough.
It's a chauffeur-driven limousine. Now be quiet, Billy. They're stopping near the door of the roadhouse.
Wait right here. I'll be out in a few minutes.
Say, I wonder who that is.
Of course, I may have been seeing things, but I thought that man was wearing a mask of some kind over his face.
You saw that too, huh? He was wearing a mask, Billy.
The chauffeur got back in the car.
Look, Billy, crawl through the grass toward that door.
What, gee, Jack, do we have to?
I want to find out who that man is.
Okay, there's no use arguing with you. Let's go.
Quiet, Billy, quiet. That chauffeur may have his windows open. He'll hear us.
Go on, these mosquitoes.
Billy, quiet, I said.
I'm trying to be quiet, Jack, but that mosquito just bit me.
All right. Bill, crawl to the left.
I hope that moon stays back of those clouds. If that chauffeur is a member of their gang and sees it. Oh, boy, why do I have to get into situations like this?
Freeze, Billy, freeze. The chauffeur's throwing his spotlight over this way. Don't move, Billy, don't move.
I couldn't move if I wanted to, Jack. My belt snagged on a piece of baling wire.
Don't try to loosen it now. There, he swung the light back again. Come on, let's move forward.
Look, let's get up and make a run for it. The door's only about 10 feet away.
No, Billy, keep crawling. Stop talking. Okay, Billy, come on now. Let's get inside the door.
Shall I close the door, Jack?
Wait till I throw out this night switch.
Where to now, Jack?
Straight ahead to that door leading down to the basement. Same one we listened at before. Now, Billy, if you hear anyone coming, get back up on that chandelier.
I feel like a monkey sitting up there.
That doesn't make any difference. All right, now hold it. Here's the door.
But you're not giving me a chance to explain, Senator. There's nothing to explain. You double-crossed me, and you know what I do to double-cross it. Yes, I've heard of your crude methods of disposal.
I wonder who that guy is.
I don't know, Billy. Listen.
You've been king of this racket long enough. From now on, I'm running this town, see? Senator, you're being very foolish. You should have let me explain how this whole thing happened. You tried to explain it once. I don't believe a word you told me. You're just trying to throw a scare into me for some reason or other. Well, I don't scare easy, mister.
Every word I told you is the truth, Senator.
How can I believe a man wearing a mask? Take that mask off your face.
Not as long as I'm alive, Senator.
Look, Mr. Wise Guy, I'm the one that's holding the gun this time. I said take the mask off, didn't I?
Keep away from the Senator, you'll be sorry.
Make one move and I'll drill you.
There must be some enemy of the silencers.
Jack, let's get out of here.
I'll make one move and it'll be your last. You won't take the mask off, huh? All right, then I will. It can't be. No. It can't be. You.
Senator, now that you know who I am, that's the last thing you'll ever do.
I wonder what's happening down there now.
I can't hear a thing. Neither one of them are saying anything. Oh, they're coming up the stairway. Let's get outside.
Yes, Billy, let's. Hurry. Dive into that high grass again, Billy.
Okay, Jack, let's go.
Right behind you, Billy. No, keep quiet, Billy. Keep quiet, for goodness sakes. Don't move a muscle. Wearing the mask.
Did you get a look at his face?
No, he had his head pulled over it. Well, there he goes. I wonder what happened in there. It's funny the silencer didn't come out, too. Come on, Billy. We're going inside there and find out.
What is the mystery of Quiet Haven? Something happened inside that roadhouse. What was it? Oh, boy, you will want to know, and so will I. So be sure, all of you, to listen in Monday to the next exciting episode of Jack Armstrong and the Black Vulture.
Oh, they had all sorts of gimmicks. They had the usual sand pits and clip-clops for horses and all sorts of special devices that they had before the tape decks came in that we have now. where the sound man just pushes those buttons and all those preset tapes spring into life. So they had to create, and they had a big water tank for all sorts of water sounds. You know, they'd slosh around in that with paddles. There was one time, a marvelous instance, where Franklin McCormick, the announcer, in the three-quarter of an hour break. Did I tell you about this? He went down to the drugstore in the merchandise mart and got the biggest king-size box of bubble bath he could find. And there was a tremendous battle with crocodiles or alligators on the show that day. So we get into the second show, and he had, during the break, sifted into the sound effects tank the entire box of the bubble bath. And you couldn't see it in there. You know, it just sank in, and that was it, as long as you didn't disturb it. So we get on the air, start Jack Armstrong, and away they go. And into the battle with the Caymans. And the more they battle, the more the foam rises, and it covered the entire tank, and these guys are working like mad. They just are trying to get more sound out of it, and it's absolute silence. They were covered with the suds. You couldn't hear anything. You could hardly see them, and the director wouldn't talk to anybody for 2 weeks because he didn't know who'd done it. Who had done it, not who done it. Well, Knox Reeves, Minneapolis, controlled Jack Armstrong, and it was sort of a joint effort, I guess, with Jim Jewell and the people from the agency, and I can't tell you for sure who the writers were. As I say, I was a tail-end Charlie. I got in on the last few good years of big-time serial radio. It was very much like the Old West. It fit almost exactly the same time period, the heyday of it. The most important section of it occurred in a period somewhere between 20 and 25 years. And it is remarkable that something of such short duration would have that much impact, as the Old West has been, you know, reliving on our TV screens and in books and everywhere you turn. We've cowboys forever and ever. I guess because we have a clear-cut hero and a clear-cut bad man in the Old West. And the radio serials, possibly they live so much and people are still so interested in them because they were the theater of the mind. You could do anything on radio and people would build their own sets in their minds and would build whatever they wished, and it appealed to your imagination. Fantasy particularly goes extremely well on radio.
This director of ours was one of the toughest directors. Nothing ever let down. And I'm referring not only to us kids, but to the adults as well. You just never let anything down before David Owen. It's awfully hard for some of the adults to work for him. They couldn't take the pace. They couldn't take the gaff. I guess being youngsters, we kind of worked our way into it. I wouldn't want to go through it again.
Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, is on the air, in person, to get you to eat Wheaties. Yesterday, Jack made his way safely across the treacherous ice floes, carrying a line to the Pelican. And here we are a short time later. The Breeches Boy is working, and the crew from the Pelican is being rescued one by one. Here comes one of them across the ice now. Listen.
Faster, men! Heave on that rope!
Oh, I almost wish Jack would start back over the ice.
I believe there'll be time. Roberts is almost here.
Stand by the gravy, men! Get him out quick!
Send him up here when he's aboard, McGregor!
Aye, aye, sir!
I'll bet he'll never want another ride like that.
Aye. I'm kicking myself for not bringing him back on the island on the Penguin. Then we'd have Jack coming aboard this trip instead.
They've got him. They're lifting him out. Oh, I hope he's not hurt. He's not. He's standing on his feet.
Forward with him, men. Watch me go. Robert, get forward. The captain wants to see you.
Aye, that I do. Come here, Robert.
Yes, Captain Campbell.
You needn't be scared anymore. You're safe, man.
It's not that. I had the wind knocked out of me, that's all. I'm grateful to you, Captain.
Stuart, what's wrong on the Pelican? Why was Hans raving at you?
He's got it in for me. He made me wait till all the rest of the men had been brought across.
We know that, but why? What was he excited about when you left?
Does he think the Pelican's going down?
No, not right away, unless
Unless what?
Unless the gasoline explodes.
Oh, gosh, racist.
What's that you say? Is there gasoline on the Pelican?
Yes, an extra supply for the plane, but it's stowed forward. That's why I didn't mention it to the captain when the fire started. The fire was aft. I thought the men could put it out.
But great Scott, it should have been thrown overboard anyhow.
Aye, now I understand. No wonder Hans turned on you, Roberts. And I think I know what happened. You didn't mention it to him because you were afraid he'd ask you to go below and get it.
I might have been trapped down there. The lights were out. None of the other men would go. And there's no danger even now. The flames are nowhere near it yet.
It'd only take a spark to set it off.
But I looked down the hatch only a while ago. It's still dark where the gasoline's stored.
That's all, Robert. Get below. You'll be given a bunk and all the food you want. And try to keep out of my sight from now till we set you down in port.
Okay, if that's the way you feel about it.
By Jove, that gasoline is serious.
Yeah. Jack wouldn't have stayed there if he knows it's on board.
Goodness, no. He should have started back over the ice long ago.
I'm sure he knows what he's doing. You can't tell much from what Robert says. We'll get a straighter story from Jock himself.
But no matter where that gasoline is, it's dangerous. The fire may break through a bulkhead in the hold and sweep through the whole ship like a flash.
If it does, Hans will know it. He'll order Jock over the side.
Oh, they've got the breacher's boy now. They've pulled it up on deck. But I can't tell who's getting into it.
It's Jack. Hans is helping him.
Fine.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Boy, that's great.
Oh, at last.
McGregor! Stand by to heave the minute the jerk comes. But take it slower this time. It's Jack that's coming.
Aye, aye, sir. You hear that, man? We're pulling the lad over next. Aye, sir.
He's ready. He's ready.
All the way, men. Give her a strong, steady pull.
Oh, Jack's safe now. He's safe at last.
Aye, there's no more danger for him.
But the Pelican may go down when he's halfway across.
He can come the rest of the way on foot if it does.
Sure he can. But, gee, I hope we have time to save Captain Haynes.
It'll be a close shave if we do. The flames are spreading much faster now. I'm sure they're sweeping into the forward part of the ship.
Seems to me she's settling more.
She is. The stern's much lower than it was.
Tell the men to pull faster on Jack. He won't mind.
McGregor, a little stronger in the hull there. You can get them here quicker without hurting them any.
Aye, aye, sir. Faster, men. Speed her up a little.
Oh, he's more than halfway here.
Yep. He's past that open stretch of water he had to jump.
I say.
What is it, Northrop?
I can see that stretch of water plainer than I could before. It's wider. Much wider than it was.
Oh, it's been spreading then.
Yeah. And I'll bet it was spreading when Jack made the jump. He knew it was. That's why he didn't try to come back on foot.
Oh, of course.
Aye, that explains it.
Stand by the grabbing when he comes aboard.
No. Stand back, men. I'll lift the lad down with my own hands.
Come on!
Listen to that. He's calling us.
Yay, Jack! Good boy!
Jack! Jack!
We're waiting for you, lad.
Well done, Jack.
Swing him clear of the rail.
Oh, Jack, you're safe at last.
I've got him. There you are, lad. And a great job you've done.
Watch, Captain. Send the breeches back quick for Captain Hans.
Back with them, McGregor.
Back they go.
They were too slow in pulling me. I thought they'd never get me here.
What's wrong? Is the Pelican sinking?
Yes. She's starting to settle fast. She's almost clear of the ice. Captain Hans says she's getting ready for the final plunge. Besides, there's gasoline on board.
Roberts told us that. We figured that it was his fault.
It was. Haskell, a fellow in charge of the plane, started to fight the fire when it broke out. He told Roberts to go below and get the gasoline and dump it overboard. He thought Roberts had done it. So did Captain Hans. The captain only found out later that he hadn't. By that time, Haskell had been brought over in the breacher's boy. Nobody else but Roberts knew where the gasoline was. And by then, he was too scared to go after it.
Ha, the coward. I thought so.
By Jove. Then the ship may blow up any minute.
Yeah. I wanted Captain Hans to come on the last trip instead of me. I said I'd take a chance on coming back across the ice. He wouldn't let me, though. He sure got nerve.
Just as well he held you back. There's a spreading stretch of open water.
I know. A couple of other places are starting to open out, too. The whole mass of flows is shifting all the time.
Oh, look. The flames are spreading almost to where Captain Hans is standing by the forward mast.
Gosh, they'll burn the rope before he gets the breeches on deck.
He'll have another minute or so, but no more.
Where are the breeches? Can you see, Professor?
Yes, they're almost there. He's pulling them up to the rail. And he's got them.
Gee, now if he can only get clear of the ship. If he's stranded out on the ice, I'll go after him.
McGregor, get ready.
Stand by the pool, men.
Oh, if he'd only hurry.
He's getting into them. I believe he's all set.
Yes, there's a jerk on the rope.
Haul away, men.
Bring them home, lad.
Oh, he's off the ship at last.
None too soon. I'll give her 5 more minutes at the most.
Less than that, I'd say. When the gasoline explodes, the whole bottom will fall out.
It won't be long. Look how the flames are sweeping over the whole deck.
The men had better pull hands faster till they get him past that open water.
Yeah, we don't want the rope to give way when he's over it.
Faster on the hull, McGregor.
Faster, men.
Boy, I believe we're going to get him here.
Oh, I
headstone.
The worst is over. He's more than halfway across.
Then he's safe. He can walk in from there.
Aye. We'll have him for a passenger. I'm glad he's rescued, but I wish he could go home on another ship.
Never mind, Captain. You'll have him in your power.
I want no power over him. I want as little to do with him as possible.
Stand by to lift him clear of the rail, men.
Gee, he's going to make it all the way.
Just barely. Hang on to him, men, when you catch hold of him. The flames will reach the hawser at the other end.
We've got him.
I need no help. Let go. Where's the spokesman?
Right beside you, Hans.
Oh, it's turned about, eh, Campbell? You rescued me this time. Or rather, the boy did. You'd never have done it without him. But we're quits, you hear?
Aye, we're quits. We'll forget the whole thing.
Aye, that we will. There's been too much rescuing on his voyage. It's not to the liking.
There's been too much of other things as well, Hans. But your part in it is finished.
You can forget that part of it, too. I know what I'm beat, but I'll take no faces about it from you.
Look, look. The Pelican's going down. The gasoline exploded and finished her.
Boy, look at her plunge.
Oh, what a shame.
Ah, there she goes.
That's the last of her.
Hey, what a sight.
That's the end of your expedition, Hans.
And what of it, Scotty Campbell?
Only this. I'm putting no restraints on you, Hans. You can have the freedom of the ship till we get to port. I'm taking your word that you know when you're beat.
Then say no more about it. You needn't fear I'll take any flyaways to make a trouble for you. That's not my way, and well, you know it. But remember this. There's other ships to be had, and the sea's as wide as ever. We'll race for another prize someday, and Captain Hans will take it.
Maybe you will, and maybe you won't. But this prize is mine, and I've work to do to make it secure. Go off with you, and save your talk.
There, you'll see no more of me than I can help. Scotchman.
McGregor, set the regular watch. Post the lookout. We're steaming away from here as quick as possible. It's back to our regular course again, and full speed for the home port.
So the Penguin is homeward bound with Captain Hans beaten at last. Will our friends reach port safely? Be sure to listen in at the same time next Monday evening to find out what happens next. This is David Owen saying goodbye for Jack Armstrong and the makers of Wheaties.
They're whole wheat with all of the bran. Won't you try Wheaties?
Reminiscing, I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
With us next week for another nostalgic look at radio of yesteryear.
And now it's just about time we were picking up our memories and moving along our way. I hope you've enjoyed listening to these songs and the memories that go with them as much as I've enjoyed bringing them to you. And I'll be keeping my weather eye peeled, yes, sir, looking for you all to join us the next time we drop around this way for a friendly little get-together. And I hope that'll be real soon, folks. And until then, this is your old friend, Singin' Sam, saying goodbye for now.
Same Time, Same Station is produced for KRLA News and Public Affairs by John Price. Associate Producer, Cam Currier. Special Research by Martin Halperin. I'm Bill Browning. Our thanks to Jim Amici and Mike Rye for their memories of the All-American Boy.
Be sure to be with us next week at this same time, same station.